Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, Pope Benedict receives in private audience the president of the Western African nation of Benin, marking World Day of Migrants and Refugees. Spotlight on a meeting between Catholic bishops from the Holy Land and other Catholic bishops from across Europe, the United States and Canada. And our popular Latin lover speaks to us about the Venerable Bede. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. On Saturday, Pope Benedict received in private audience the president of the Western African nation of Benin, Thomas Yayi Boni. Charles Collins reports.
Benin is a small French-speaking West African country between Togo and Nigeria. Although poor, it's considered a model for the rest of the region politically, having run successful multi-party elections in 2006. The winner of that contest, Thomas Yayi Boni, met with Pope Benedict in the Vatican Saturday morning. A communique issued by the Holy See Press Office said the two spoke about the difficult economic situation in the country, which has only gotten worse due to heavy flooding last year. The president also thanked the Holy Father for the significant contributions made by the Catholic Church in the development of the country, in teaching, health, and the promotion of humanity. The president is a Christian in a country where many of the people follow local religions, although Christians make up 30% of the country's nearly 8 million people, the majority of these Catholics. After meeting the Holy Father, President Boni came to the studios of Vatican Radio, where he said that religious faith is the most important thing in his nation.
La nation béninoise, comme nous avons coutume de le rappeler, est une nation.
He said Benin is a country that has long been in harmony with God, because a nation which turns away from God will be ruined, be it Benin or any other country. He said that this is the reason that he felt it was important to come to the See of Peter and transmit the goodwill of the country. The president admitted that some ask if this religiosity interferes with the government, but he emphasized that the republic is secular. But he says this does not change the fact that the people of Benin believe in God, and that without God, nothing is possible, as is clear from the messages from the See of Peter. President Boni says the Republic of Benin has made its choice in this regard, and as a people who try to bring this message to others, the people of Benin, in return, receive blessings from God.
Well, thanks there to Charles Collins for bringing us the voice of the president of the Western African nation of Benin, Thomas Yayi Boni. And now moving on to Sunday, 13th of January, the day the church remembers in a special way migrants and refugees, we take a look at Pope Benedict's message, which, as is the custom, was released for the occasion ahead of time, precisely on October the 18th, 2007. A message which focused, in particular this year, on young migrants, those who find themselves displaced for economic or academic reasons, or more dramatically as refugees. But before speaking of the Pope's message this year, I'd like to step back in time for a moment to the days when the celebration was first inaugurated by another Roman pontiff who took the name Benedict. He's Benedict XV, whose pontificate sadly coincided with the outbreak of the First World War back in 1914, bringing with it not only a useless slaughter of lives, but the displacement of entire peoples, something this early 20th century pope showed his awareness of in establishing a special day dedicated to these displaced peoples, a day which has been respected ever since. At this point, getting back to Pope Benedict's message this year, let's listen to what the Secretary of the Pontifical Council for the Pastoral Care of Migrants and Itinerant Peoples, Archbishop Agostino Marchetto, told my Italian colleague Gianni Peduto.
The Holy Father invites us to reflect clearly on the young migrant people, starting from the understanding that the result is that many times the young people endowed with the best intellectual resources leave their countries of origin, whilst in the countries that must receive the migrants, laws are in force that make their actual insertion difficult. From this, the Pope deduces that rightly, therefore, the public institutions, humanitarian organizations, and also the Catholic Church are dedicating many of their resources to helping these people in difficulty. The young migrants are particularly sensitive, the Holy Father says, to the problems that derive from the so-called difficulty of dual belonging. Between them, indicates Pope Benedict, are young women who fall victim more easily to exploitation, moral forms of blackmail, and even abuses of all kinds, whilst unaccompanied adolescents and minors often end up on the street, abandoned to themselves and prey to unscrupulous exploiters. Next, particularly attention is given to young refugees and to the foreign students. Firstly, in order to limit myself to the very important issue of education, the Holy Father also asserts that adequate programs will have to be prepared, both in the scholastic and the work context, in order to guarantee their preparation and provide the necessary basis for a correct insertion into the new social, cultural, and professional world. For the international students, the Pope hopes that they will be helped to find a way to open up to the dynamism of interculturality and be enriched in their contact with other students of different cultures and religions. For young Christians, this study and formation experience can be a useful area for the maturation of their faith, a stimulus to be open to the universalism that is a constitutive element of the Catholic Church.
That was the Secretary of the Pontifical Council for the Pastoral Care of Migrants and Itinerant Peoples, Archbishop Agostino Marchetto. Meanwhile, moving on in the broadcast, let's join another of my colleagues, Philippa Hitchin, who's currently in the Holy Land, taking part as an observer at a meeting between Catholic bishops from the Holy Land and other Catholic leaders from across Europe, the United States and Canada. But before I speak to her more specifically about her personal pilgrimage there, I'd like to remark how it happened to coincide with a visit to that part of the world of the United States President George W. Bush, who spent 2 days in Israel and the West Bank, hearing out both sides in disputes about land and security. Philippa asked one of the Americans in her group, Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, who met with President Bush and with Middle East envoy Tony Blair, for a comment. Let's listen.
Well, I think it was a good visit. I think he took people with hope and gave them more hope. I think he took people who had no hope and gave them at least some glimmer of hope. Is the president realistic? I hope he is. I hope that if we all work together, we can come to a solution. It's not going to solve all the problems that exist. For example, the problem of Gaza will probably still go on for a while. But it will be something that will give people a greater sense of finishing up what has been a work in progress and sometimes a work without progress for a long time.
As you know, he talked quite openly about the occupation, Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories. We haven't heard that kind of language much before from the Bush administration. Is this marking a shift, do you think, in attitude that may be a little bit more insistent upon Israel moving out of the territories?
Well, I think it marks another stage in the journey toward a two-state solution. I think that the use of the word, I'm not sure how conscious the president was. I guess he wouldn't have used it if they had not anticipated that it would create some, at least eyebrow-raising in some parts of this area. But I think it shows that he is more realist than we think he might be, and that he does believe that whatever you call the situation that we face, that there has to be a resolution of it, and that this resolution has to come soon rather than later.
That was Philippa Hitchens speaking there to Cardinal Theodore McCarrick. But now let's hear more from Philippa regarding the annual meeting I mentioned a moment ago. Philippa, this is an annual meeting, one you've attended before. I believe in a nutshell it's designed to bring support, solidarity and of course much needed hope to a Christian community which lives daily in a particularly distressing situation. How does one go about bringing help then?
You're absolutely right. These Holy Land coordination visits, as they're called, have been going on for nearly a decade now. They were started in response to a request for help and support from the local Catholic bishops to try and stem the exodus of Christians, so many of them trying in any way possible to go abroad. And so the Catholic leaders here are very concerned to try and stop this exodus, to try and encourage people to stay here in Jerusalem and in the Holy Land. So how do the other Catholic bishops try and do that? Well, basically in three ways. The moderator at last year's meeting, Bishop William Kenny, described it as the three P's. That's P for prayer, pilgrimage, and pressure. First of all, they come to pray. They come to pray with the local Catholic community here. And the centerpiece of these meetings is always on a Sunday. The bishops go to different local parishes, not necessarily just Roman Catholic, but also Greek Melkite, for example, Maronite parishes, Armenian Catholic parishes, to pray with people, to listen to the liturgies in their local languages, and then to go back home to their own parishes, their own diocese, and to encourage people to pray. To pray for peace in Jerusalem and to pray for the Holy Land. Secondly, pilgrimage. Well, any visit to Jerusalem is, of course, in itself a pilgrimage as you walk through the gates of the old city and you walk along the Via Dolorosa, you walk in the footsteps of Jesus on his last days here on earth. And again, they go back home and they encourage local people in their own countries to come on pilgrimage to the Holy Land, despite the fact that so often it's been difficult. The violence in here has meant that people have kept away from the city. It's a very safe place to visit, and people here depend on the tourist trade for their livelihood. That's one way in which they will be able to stay here and not seek to emigrate abroad. So the tourist industry is vital for this city and for this country, and so one of the main tasks of the bishops is to encourage people to come on pilgrimage. And I was talking this morning, for example, to some of the Sisters of Zion here. They run a guest house and a study program, and they've confirmed what the statistics say, that pilgrimages are on the increase here, which is a very good sign. Despite the difficulties, people are beginning to come in increasing numbers to visit the sites, to stay here, and so that's a very important part of this mission. And thirdly, pressure. Well, on Monday, the bishops are due to meet with Israeli and Palestinian officials in Jerusalem and in Ramallah, and then again they are expected to go back to their own countries and expected to lobby their own governments, European governments, American government, Canadian government, to try and seek solutions, to try and seek ways to overcome the mistrust, the suspicion, and the difficulties that are so deeply rooted in this country.
Philippa, you went on your own personal pilgrimage this morning in Jerusalem. That's Friday morning. Where did you go exactly? Along the Via Dolorosa, I think.
That's exactly right. Friday is a very important day here. It's the day in which the Franciscans, in fact, lead a pilgrimage every Friday along the Via Dolorosa, the Way of the Cross, or the Way of Sorrows, It's the route which Jesus walked from being condemned to die towards Golgotha, the place of the crucifixion. And there are 14 stations marked here along the way, along the old stones, the winding roads here. 9 of these stations are along the narrow streets, and 5 of them are inside the Church of the Holy Sepulchre itself. And they're all marked as places where you can stop and pray. And in the one sense, it's a little confusing because there are so many tourists, I found this morning, walking along this way of the cross. You're surrounded by flashing cameras and people buying postcards. It can be quite disorienting. But at the same time, these are places where if you find yourself a quiet corner and you can sit down for a moment and you can relive, in effect, the events of Holy Week. And so it's a very spiritual experience. And then you end up in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and you can stay and pray inside there for as long as you like. Many different groups of pilgrims all around you stopping to pray there. It's a very, very, very moving experience.
Philippa, Friday in Jerusalem is a special day for the members of one of the 3 monotheistic religions present there, no? The Muslims. I imagine this was physically visible today, right?
Absolutely. Friday is, as you say, the holiest day for the Muslims as well. And it is an extraordinary sight. At 12 o'clock, you hear the minarets calling Muslims to prayer, and literally thousands of them come pouring in through the old gates, the ancient gates, into the old city. And a wave of them come down these old winding streets, carrying their prayer mats, heading towards the main mosque here in Jerusalem. And it is a very, very interesting sight to see them all moving towards this mosque, which of course is also right next door to the Western Wall, one of the holiest sites for Jews. And so at the same time, within a few yards, you can literally see these extraordinary places for Christianity, this important place for Muslims. It's the 3rd holiest city after Mecca and Medina, and right next door, the Western Wall, where Jews gather to pray, the men on the one side and the women on the other. And so you can sense at the same time the sacredness of this place, and yet you can also understand the difficulties, the real problems that are involved in trying to find a lasting political solution to a city that is so important, so sacred to these 3 monotheistic faiths.
My thanks there go to Philippa Hitchin, speaking to us from the Holy Land. We'll be hearing more from her in the next few days. Finally, on a very different note, it's time to join our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, and he speaks to us today of the Venerable Bede, at the request of a listener. You have quite a bit of fan mail. How do you say fan mail in Latin?
Okay. Fautorum cum fautorum nunci. Or epistulae fautorum of supporters.
So this man, he's from Oak Park, Illinois. He writes, "Hi, the regular English program feature the Latin lover. Father Reginald Foster explains various aspects of the use of Latin, particularly within the church. I've heard the Latin used by St. Bede the Venerable described as beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
And many other positive ways. His writings influenced such saints, as if memory serves, Thomas Aquinas, Bonaventure, Robert Bellarmine, and many others. And is the only Englishman in Dante's Paradiso.
Oh.
Unfortunately, I'm not in a position to discern. I would be interested in Father Foster's assessment of St. Bede's Latin. So, what's St. Bede's Latin like?
Well, no, it's really very, very wonderful. He wrote the history of the church in England and all those nice things. And, I mean, for his time, I mean, it's very, very elegant. Probably the best of people writing at his time.
His time was known as the Dark Ages.
Yeah, which is really not true at all. I mean,
how do you say the Dark Ages?
I mean, okay. Secula obscura. Tenebricosa.
He was an English scholar monk who travelled no further than Lindisfarne, right? Yet was renowned everywhere, even across the world, right?
Oh, yeah.
The brothers on Lindisfarne, where he lived at one point, asked him to write the biography of their great saint, Cuthbert. Have you read the biography of the great saint Cuthbert?
No.
Cuthbert was a shepherd boy who, at the age of 15, had a vision while watching sheep. Right?
Yeah, I don't know. I know people by the name of Cuthbert.
How do you say vision? A shepherd boy had a vision while watching sheep.
Custodiens oves accepit visionem puer.
And then he had lots of wild stories about Cuthbert, no? For example, in snakes, he said, no reptile is to be seen in Ireland. How would he have said that in Latin, in his beautiful Latin?
Serpentes nullas videri licet in Hibernia.
No snake can live there.
Neque ibi vivere possunt.
For although snakes have often been taken there from Britain, as the boat approaches the land, they are affected by the scent of its air and perish. In other words, snakes perish in Ireland. How do you say that?
Periunt serpentes in Hibernia.
In fact, almost everything that comes from that island gives protection against poison.
Oh, my.
How do you say that?
Fere omnia quae ibi nascuntur presidium adversus venenam prebent.
For example, when people were suffering from snake bite, well, he said there weren't any snakes, but in Ireland, so I don't know why he says this, but we have seen leaves of manuscripts from Ireland scraped, and the scrapings dropped in water and given as a drink, and this treatment immediately took away all the pain of spreading poison and completely reducing the swelling.
Yeah, that's interesting.
How do you say all that in Latin?
No, I'm not going to.
Yes, you are.
You can.
Okay, an antidote against snake bite.
Remedium adversus serpentium morsus.
Manuscripts from Ireland scraped and the scrapings dropped in water and given as a drink.
Codices ex Hibernia illate. What are you going to say? Scalpe bantur. Et reliquiae aqua miscebantur.
And took away all the pain of spreading poison and completely reduced the swelling.
What is spreading poison?
Well, the poison, the snake poison.
Took away the pain of spreading poison.
Yeah.
Abule, hic omni abstulerum dolores veneni serpentis.
And completely reduced the swelling.
Et omnino compescuit tumorem. What is this all about, Cuthbert?
Yeah.
Oh, Lord.
In the life of Cuthbert, it's about animals. We have Cuthbert who immersed himself in the cold North Sea and emerged to be dried by two otters. This is from the life of Cuthbert, from Bede's life of Cuthbert, right?
Yeah.
And basically what happened was that one night one of the brothers of the monastery saw him going silently out. This was Cuthbert, no? And they secretly followed in his footsteps to discover where he was going and what his purpose was. It's like spying on him, no? How do you say spying?
Speculabantur eum.
Anyway, this was night time, no? When dawn approached, he went onto the land and again began to pray, kneeling on the shore. As he did so, there at once came out from the depths of the sea 2 4-footed creatures, which are commonly called otters.
Otters? What are otters? Oh, I know otters, like sea lions or something.
Well, we can call them like that.
I don't even know. I don't know. I don't know my animals.
Okay, well, how do you say otters came out of the sea?
Bene, quadrupedes emergerunt mari.
Stretching themselves out in front of him on the sand, they began to warm his feet with their breath.
Oh.
How do you say that?
Say in arena, protendentes, well, extendentes, ceperun calefacere eus pedes.
And sought to dry him on their fur, like there were beach towels or something.
Intelligo, bene. Suaque pelle eum arefacere.
Like beach towels?
Upstairs, Jerry. Upstairs, Jerry.
He didn't say that, I did.
No, I understand. I understand. What are you going to say? Manu tergia maritima. Sea towels.
They're not, they're beach towels. How do you say beach?
They didn't have a word. They didn't have no litus. Litoria. Manu tergia litoria.
Having performed their services, they received his blessing and slid back beneath the waves in which they lived. Cuthbert also soon returned home and sang the hymns of the office with the brothers at the proper hour. So basically what happened was that Cuthbert, after having had the otters dry him because he was all soaked, this was like a miracle, no?
Yeah, yeah.
How do you say miracle?
A miraculum, that's easy. Era quasi miraculum, ferre miraculum.
He returned home and sang the hymns of the office with the brothers at the proper hour. So just tell me how you say that, and then tell
Carmina cum fratribus, stato tempore concinebat.
What hymns would he have sung, Cuthbert?
Well, in those days,
Latin hymns.
Oh, yeah, there's no question about that. I don't know how old and which ones. It's, you have to study that whole thing there. No, Bede is really wonderful.
What's so special about his Latin?
I mean, for his time, it's very polished, elegant. No, it's not like spaghetti Latin or anything like that. It's very educated and elegant, and it's exceptional. Exceptional.
Who would you compare him to?
Well, I don't know what. Well, Isidore. No. He's better than Isidore.
But, one of the Roman authors.
Maybe like Nepos or something like that. I mean, simple and clear and neat and elegant, really. No, it's a delight to read Bede. Especially when he talks about the beginnings of, and the Romans were in England, and he goes through that the whole history of England. He's considered the father of no English history, Bede. Mm. Oh, no, he's great. He's very, very good. People should read that stuff.
Who were his contemporaries?
I don't know where. I don't know what we're talking about. Where are we? I don't know. I can't even think of any. Because, as I say, he never even left the thing there, and so...
He lived at the midpoint of that epoch long referred to as the Dark Ages.
Yeah, well, now they say that's really not true. I mean, they were much more illuminated than is generally thought. Everything they think it was just like, living in caves and stuff. No, there was quite a lot of scholarship.
That took place in monasteries, no?
Well, yeah, especially like, the Celtics, the Irish monks, and they were copying books and manuscripts.
Illustrated manuscripts.
Oh, that went on.
How do you say illustrated manuscript?
Bah, coniu codices illustratos, pictos. And so that was going on full blast. So even when we were doing history 45 years ago, my teacher, who's in Spain now, he would say, really, it's an exaggeration of one or two German historians who considered those ages so dark. But really, they weren't as dark as they are said to be.
And they had otters coming out of
the water. Well, that's dark enough.
A big thank you there, as always, to Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, better known as our popular Latin lover, who's currently working at the Vatican's Secretariat of State as the Pope's own Latinist. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening, and should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Laudetur Jesus Christus.